Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Nathaniel Raymond of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health, who talks about Sudan's catastrophic civil war, which has created the worst act of genocide and famine in the world today. Jennifer Lowenstein, former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who discusses the dire situation for Palestinians living in post-ceasefire Gaza. And Salon.com columnist Heather Digby Parton, who examines President Trump's sudden reversal on the release of the Epstein files and how it lends credence to what many describe as one of the biggest political cover-ups in U.S. history. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over 250 Venezuelans who were deported to El Salvador's prisons by Donald Trump in March and April suffered systematic and prolonged torture and abuse, including sexual assault during their detention, according to a report published by Human Rights Watch and Crystal Sol, a Central American human rights group. The report says conditions at El Salvador's infamous CICOT prison violated UN standards for prisoner treatment, citing inhumane prison conditions, including solitary confinement and inadequate food. According to The Guardian, while the Trump regime attempted to stigmatize the deportees of being members of the Tren de Aragua gang, only 3% had been convicted of a crime in the U.S. The groups accused the Trump regime of willful complicity in the suffering the deportees endured in CICOT, insisting that U.S. officials ordered the men's deportation despite knowing they would be mistreated or even face threats to their lives. Human rights groups are calling for an end to the U.S. deportation of detainees to El Salvador, as well as an independent investigation. The U.S. government approved the sale of sniper rifles to a deadly police unit in Brazil last year, overriding concerns from the Biden administration's ambassador to Brazil that the arms could be used in extrajudicial killings. Reuters reports that the Rio de Janeiro police unit that purchased the guns, known as BOPE, played a central role in a raid in late October in Rio's Peña neighborhood that left 117 civilians dead. However, none of those killed by police in the raid were among the 69 suspects named by prosecutors. Rio police, of which BOPE is the most notorious unit, were responsible for 703 killings in 2024. But in April, the Trump regime rescinded President Biden's guidance that placed tighter restrictions on U.S. gun exports. Relatives of the fallen described evidence of summary executions, including bound limbs, knife wounds, and gunshots to the face and neck. The Rio state government said the operation was its largest ever to target the Comando Vermelho gang, which controls the drug trade in several favela neighborhoods. According to ProPublica, during the early days of the Trump administration, Leland Dudek, an IT security official at the Social Security Administration, attempted to enlist billionaire Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE's young tech staffers, into updating the agency's out-of-date technology. Dudek was put on leave for sharing information with DOGE without authorization, but soon after, President Trump appointed him acting Social Security Commissioner. Dudek was largely ignored by DOGE staff, who instead attempted to document Musk's false accusation that the Social Security system was guilty of handing out benefits to large numbers of dead people. Dudek later attempted to reverse DOGE directives and leaked information to the press about policies he believed would harm beneficiaries. After Dudek's dismissal in May, Frank Bisignano took over as commissioner and adopted many DOGE policies. Critics argue that these changes have degraded the quality of service for millions of beneficiaries who continue to suffer from the system's instability and departure of over 5,000 long-time Social Security employees. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The nation of Sudan is the site of the worst act of genocide and famine in the world today. On October 26th, El-Fashir, the capital of North Darfur, and the Sudanese army's last stronghold in the region, fell to the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Since the city's fall, widespread atrocities have been reported, including mass killings, ethnically motivated violence, and sexual assault. More than 150,000 people are estimated to have died in the current civil war, with 25 million affected by famine and millions more displaced internally or as refugees. Both Sudan's armed forces and the RSF, which have been engaged in a deadly war with each other since April 2023, were created by Sudan's dictator Omar al-Bashir, who was overthrown in 2019. The RSF is an outgrowth of the Janjaweed, Arab militias that committed genocide against black African Muslims in Darfur in the early 2000s. Nathaniel Raymond, executive director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health, has worked as a war crimes investigator for 26 years. Over the past 15 years, he's used remote sensing technology to detect and document threats to the security of civilians. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Raymond about the evolution and current state of Sudan's war, which included the RSF's 18-month siege of Al-Fashir, leading to the highest of five levels of famine for the 500,000 people who are sheltering there.
The RSF launched a sneak attack on the SAF to try to consolidate control of the government. And it was then that our team from the Humanitarian Research Lab at Yale was brought in by the State Department to support the first U.S. and Saudi effort to attempt to negotiate an end to the war, which was called the Jeddah process at the start of the Civil War. Contemporaneous to that, RSF forces began to attack the Darfur population in the West and used the Civil War as cover for action to attempt to reignite and complete the Darfur genocide. We began to detect in the far western part of the country fires using a NASA thermal sensor called VIIRS. We began to detect fires in communities where there was no Sudan Armed Forces. And in fact, the Sudan Armed Forces in the city of El Geneina in the late spring, early summer of 2023 walked across the border into Chad and left the Masalit people there in the city of Geneina, which is the capital of the Masalit tribe, to die. And what proceeded to happen after that was a house-to-house hunt for men and boys and killing over weeks of men and boys in El Geneina. And we monitored that from above. This is very important when we get to El-Fashir, is that with Geneina, we saw genocidal violence and we were able to get ground photos of the bodies, and we use that to develop a calibration to measure bodies in satellite imagery based on having validated photographs of them on the ground. It was then after that massacre that within the U.S. government, we issued the first warning that we thought they would go and attempt the same thing in El-Fashir with the four and the Zagawa. During the Darfur genocide, the international community deployed a UN peacekeeping force called UNAMID, and its headquarters was in El-Fashir. And many of the four in the Zagawa that fled, along with other tribes that fled the genocide gathered 20 years ago around El-Fashir. So we briefed the UN Security Council in private session in July 2023 and told them that there would be an attack and a siege likely in the dry season of 2023 into 2024 that would put Al-Fashir under siege. And if the siege failed, it would kill tens of thousands in a massacre, which would be the final battle of the Darfur genocide. We proceeded to leave US government service in the winter of 2024 over a lack of action on the risk to Al-Fashir. And so we raised replacement money and we've camped out on Al-Fashir since then because we believe that we had the best chance to protect the most people by focusing on Al-Fashir. On October 26, SAF negotiated a deal in the night to escape to the West, once again leaving the civilians to RSF. And the 26th and the 27th, we began to see objects on the streets between 1.3 meters, which is about 3 feet, to 2 meters, which is about 6 feet. The smaller ones are children, the larger ones are adults. Some messages got out, and sources told us on Monday morning, 1,200 were dead. By Monday evening, they messaged again, and 10,000 were dead. By Tuesday, we couldn't reach them anymore.
It's just horrific. Are we to assume that the slaughter is ongoing even as we speak, or what do we know?
Absolutely. We can see house-to-house raids, and we see a level of movement of remains that suggests it's still ongoing.
But one thing I did want you to talk about is the role of the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, in this whole horrible situation.
Classified U.S. intelligence assessments said that the U.S. government had known for months that the United Arab Emirates had been supplying weapons to the Rapid Support Forces. But the point is, UAE has steadfastly denied their involvement as the evidence mounts that they have directly supported the RSF, including increasing arms sales and the volume of arms sales during the siege of Al-Fashir.
What about the role of the US?
The United States, the United Kingdom, and Europe has fundamentally prioritized its diplomatic, economic, and security relationship with the UAE over protecting these people. And despite UN Security Council Resolution 2736 from last summer, which we played a role in helping push for, which called for a ceasefire in Al-Fashir, the will of the Security Council has not been enforced. And the US and its partners have continued, both under Biden and the Trump administration, to push for a comprehensive end to the war rather than focusing on the imminent security threat, human security threat against non-Arab, indigenous African Muslims in Darfur.
That was Nathaniel Raymond, Executive Director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health. Find more news and analysis about Sudan's civil war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. More than a month after the Washington-brokered Gaza ceasefire was signed on October 9th, U.S. corporate media has virtually ended their coverage of the ongoing misery and death among the territory's more than 2 million Palestinian residents. Living conditions in Gaza remain desperate due to widespread destruction of homes and infrastructure, mass displacement, the collapse of the healthcare system, and severe food shortages caused by Israel's ongoing restrictions on the delivery of humanitarian aid. On November 17th, the United Nations Security Council voted to support a still vague U.S. plan to create and deploy an international stabilization force to Gaza. This, as Palestinian civilians in Gaza are still being killed and injured by Israeli forces almost on a daily basis, with over 260 deaths reported since the ceasefire went into effect. The overall death toll of Palestinians in Gaza since the war began on October 7, 2023, is estimated at more than 69,000, with many more missing and presumed dead, buried under tons of rubble. Meanwhile, a surge of Israeli settler and army violence targeting Palestinians in the occupied West Bank has resulted in over 1,000 deaths since October 2023, coinciding with escalating government property seizures, home demolitions, and the forcible displacement of thousands of West Bank residents. Your reporter spoke with Jennifer Lowenstein. former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who assesses the dire situation for Palestinians in post-ceasefire Gaza.
There was a U.S.-backed peace plan, the 20-point Trump plan that was agreed upon October 9th, 10th, by a good number of parties, including many of the Arab states. You know, this peace plan, in my view, is nothing other than a surrender document for the Gazans, because it doesn't end the occupation. It doesn't give Palestinians the right of self-determination or the right of self-governance within the Gaza Strip. It even imposes a board of peace. You got to love that name, a board of peace onto the Gaza Strip that's supposed to oversee the future. And today was important because at the United Nations, there was a vote on whether or not the second phase of this ceasefire would go forward. The second phase envisions an international stabilization force in Gaza that will coordinate with the Israeli army. In the document itself, the Palestinian Authority is supposed to ultimately control the population of Gaza. Israel has rejected that outright. In fact, Itamar Ben-Gvir has recently suggested that Mahmoud Abbas, the current head of the Palestinian Authority, be jailed or killed. This document that was voted on today also, for the International Stabilization Force, that is, it also speaks of a Palestinian state. And over the weekend, Netanyahu and his cronies made it very clear that they don't care whether this document says that there should be a credible path to a Palestinian state or not, because there will never be a Palestinian state, and that they are there to see that that remains a fact. The International Stabilization Force is also supposed to oversee the disarmament of Hamas. That would be very interesting if it ever came to pass, because it won't. Hamas is not going to disarm, certainly not voluntarily. The point is, although Russia and China abstained from this vote, it did pass. So regardless of all the different details of this stabilization force that have been written out and described and detailed, it's very likely never going to happen because Israel opposes it, Hamas opposes it, and there are no states to date offering to send their soldiers, their own military personnel, into the Gaza Strip to face off with the Palestinians and the Israelis. Now, the Palestinians rejected this for very good reason, because they don't want a foreign occupier to stay in the Gaza Strip. They don't want the Israelis, and they don't want the Indonesians or the Malaysians or anybody else who passed this agreement.
Since the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel and Israel's long-term invasion and slaughter of Palestinian civilians, there's been a critical humanitarian crisis there, not least of which is the shortage of food that has been deliberate in terms of the blockade of humanitarian aid and food coming into Gaza. What's happened since the signing of the ceasefire on October 9th in terms of food distribution as well as medical supplies and equipment?
I would like to clarify for listeners that I don't consider the ceasefire agreement a ceasefire at all. Israel has violated it over 300 times. They have killed over 250 people in Gaza alone and wounded over 1,000. What's happening with international humanitarian aid is absolutely scandalous. 600 trucks a day were the agreed-upon number of aid trucks that were supposed to be going into Gaza daily. And I want to say that 600 trucks per day is less than the number of trucks that were going in daily before October 7th, 2023. Then it was between 8 and 1,200 trucks a day, and that was considered insufficient. Right now, 600 trucks are supposed to be getting in, but because of Israeli prohibitions, approximately 150 of these trucks are getting in daily, if that. There are no medical supplies coming in. There have been, I think, 13 or 14 attempts now to bring in tents, and all of them have been rejected by the Israelis. So it's a catastrophic situation, and it's being allowed to continue. The genocide is still continuing, if in slower motion. And it's really also scandalous that none of this is making our news.
That was Jennifer Lowenstein, former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Learn more about the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On November 18th, House Republicans in full retreat, after months of obstruction and partisan delaying tactics, joined Democrats in an almost unanimous vote supporting the release of the Epstein files. Hours later, the U.S. Senate quickly approved the same legislation that directed the Justice Department to release evidence gathered in federal investigations into Donald Trump's longtime friends, convicted sex offenders Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. After months of aggressive efforts to block the legislation that would release the Epstein files, on November 16th, President Trump abruptly changed his position, saying he now supported the release of the Epstein documents. The dramatic shift occurred after it became apparent that hundreds of House Republicans would abandon the president and vote to pass the Epstein files bill. While the Epstein release legislation will soon be sent to the president's desk for signing or a veto, Trump has long had the power to unilaterally release the Epstein files on his own, without congressional action. But in a hint of a possible new tactic that could be used to prevent the release of the documents, Trump directed the Justice Department to open up new investigations into public figures associated with Jeffrey Epstein, who he labeled as Democrats. Active Justice Department criminal investigations could be cited as a reason to prevent public release or redact certain information within the Epstein files. Your reporter spoke with Heather Digby Parton, a columnist for Salon.com, who talks about President Trump's reversal on release of the Epstein files and how it lends credence to what many describe as one of the biggest political cover-ups in U.S. history.
Well, you know, he is anything but a person who is subject to shame. So, you know, being a hypocrite is just part of who he is. And he just shifted dramatically on this yesterday. But it came in, you know, as the word was coming down that they were losing Republican Congress people by the dozens on this issue and that he was going to lose that fight. And, you know, Trump can't stand to lose. So basically, he just jumped in front of the parade and decided to say, oh, you know, I've been for this all along. Where this becomes a problem for Donald Trump, beyond the obvious, of course, which is that he was great friends with Epstein and is, you know, all over the files, no doubt, certainly all over the emails that we just saw released last week. But the problem for Trump is that, you know, conspiracy theories, you know, you're either in or you're out. You're a believer or you're not. And Trump's on both sides of that. He's always been the kind of the conspiracy theorist president, buying into all this stuff. It's one of the reasons why he's so beloved by his MAGA following. And on this one, he's in the conspiracy. So, you know, he's been on the back foot here this whole time. He just does not seem to be able to find any place to control it. And I don't think he still is, even though he's now saying that he'll sign the bill. I mean, everybody knows he could release the files tomorrow if he wanted to. But he clearly does not want them to come out. And that just, of course, spurs more suspicion that there's something going on there. You know, I don't know if this particular thing indicates there's a real break within MAGA. But I do think that his attempt here to try and bring himself back into the MAGA fold is an indication that something has gone very, very much awry among his own followers.
I've been reading, and I had some thoughts myself, of course, on the fact that Trump has the veto power. But there is another way out for Trump, given the fact that he just, within the last day or two, called for new investigations of former President Clinton, J.P. Morgan Chase, Democratic funder Reid Hoffman, and former Secretary of the Treasury Larry Summers, who have been mentioned as being part of the Epstein file. Now, if those investigations are opened by Trump's Department of Justice, that would mean they have an out to say, we cannot release the files because there are current ongoing investigations happening. And of course, there could have been investigations during his first administration and certainly in these last 6 months. But this is a convenient way to stop the release, is it not?
Absolutely. And there's no doubt in my mind that that's exactly why he did that. He could release these right now if he wanted to. He has not shown any reticence to ordering the Department of Justice to do anything he wants it to. And they have not shown any kind of reluctance to follow his orders. So he could certainly do that, and he's not doing that. And I do agree that this whole thing about the new investigation that he's ordered and Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, saluting smartly and saying, yes, sir, I'll get right on that, is definitely setting that up. And interestingly, the part about that that he's so, you know, completely obsessed with about Clinton and J.P. Morgan and all the rest of them, and Reid Hoffman, I guess, Larry Summers, you know, he says they're all Democrats. And so they're the ones, he said all day today, he was saying in press appearances, this is a Democrat problem. It's a Democrat. Well, you know who was a Democrat when all this was taking place? Donald Trump. He used to be one. So, you know, I don't think that's really the great excuse that he thinks it is. And in any case, last July, the Department of Justice came out with a big report that said that they had looked at all this. They had thoroughly investigated everything they had. They went over and they did. They sent in, you know, like 100 and some FBI agents to go and comb through the files in some site out in Maryland. And I don't know if they looked at all the videos or what they did, but they actually did have people doing it. And they came out and said there was nothing in there and there was no reason to pursue any third party, that they found no evidence that would, nothing that would predicate any kind of investigation on any third parties. That was just 4 months ago. And so now they're going to do a big investigation on all these people. So the whole thing is just, it's a setup to try and keep the files out of the hands of the people. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm not thinking there's going to be any big release of any files anytime soon.
That was Heather Digby Parton, a columnist for Salon.com. Find links to her recent commentaries on the Epstein files and other issues by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana, KGHI in Westport, Washington, RECFM nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.